This program was funded by a generous grant from the Gay Auckland Business Association Charitable Trust. For more information, visit gabba.org.nz.
Hello, my name's Johnny Givens, and I am a media person, so therefore I make television programs. I train people in the media, and my background as a gay man is I'm Scottish. My whakapapa goes back to Scotland and Ireland, and I went to the great training institutions of gay people in Britain and Ireland. I went to a boarding school. So therefore I got trained, as the great homosexuals of the British Empire were, in public school. I went to school in Dunblane, outside Stirling, as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, and then my family miraculously decided to move the whole family to New Zealand. And so I had another great gay event, a cruise. We cruised the world on the Oriana, and I was 11, I think it was, you know. But I just loved it, and I've been wanting to go on cruises ever since.
At that age, and even at boarding school, I mean, did you know you were gay?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Well, I just had a wonderful time with guys. You know, I just had a really nice time. And I never thought that anything was wrong with it. I thought that's what you did. Well, it was boarding school, so we just played with each other, and we had fun, you know, and that's the sort of thing. And we never thought anything about it, really. That was just what you did. And but I had four sisters. And so my four sisters were my grounding, if you like. And so my relationship with women was with my mother and her sisters and my own sisters. And so I have a real relationship with women rather than a romantic relationship with women. So the fantasy's not there with it. And so I think my upbringing was actually about men. It was about that's where pleasure lay. And that's where fun and excitement and interesting things happened.
So how long did the boat journey take?
That took, I think it was 6 weeks to get to New Zealand. And then we arrived in Queen's Wharf, I think it was, at that stage. And the family moved to Tokoroa, where my life just became as a Kiwi kid. Of course, there was no gayness about it at all. But basically, I went to high school. I went to intermediate school, was a boy soprano, went to high school. And I never thought of myself as gay in those senses at all. I had girlfriends. I played football. I did play the school organ. You know, I did do all the singing and the dancing and the theatre and stuff like that. But that was basically because my mother was a ballet teacher. So I've got all the perfect pedigree for a gay man.
So was there any conflict in your own mind coming from a boarding school situation where you were playing with guys to suddenly being in a very kind of blokey New Zealand town?
I never felt the conflict. I discovered there was some one of the teachers who was gay, I believe, I found later, but I was really close to them. I thought he was a really good guy, but it never occurred to me that it was something different. I thought it was just that was what you did, you know. But I never had any sexual relationships with anything like that. And when I was living in Tokoroa,
did you feel that was odd?
Not really. No, it's just all. That's just how it was, you know. And I was having a lovely time filling up the big tits and, you know, just rolling around on Brimworth carpet and, you know, and just getting blue balls and all that sort of stuff you do as a teenager. I just thought of myself as a normal teenager. It wasn't until I was in my mid-20s when I really fell in love that I realized I was I was a gay guy. You know, and I'd been in love a couple of times before, I never looking back on it. But when I first fell in love with a guy, and I was 24 at the time, that's when I went, oh, fuck, this is where I am.
How did that happen?
It was another actor, and I was an actor at the time, and I'd done my university study, and I was being an actor in one of the theatres, and he came up from Wellington, he was an actor in the other theatre, and we met at a party. And I just thought he was the most attractive thing I'd ever seen. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, well, you're coming home with me. I was terribly out front. There's no alternative. And so we went home. And funnily enough, one of the girls in the house I was flattening, she thought he was coming home with her. I quickly made her clear that that was not the case. And that was. I remember going and having him, and we went to bed that night, and it was just the most wonderful sensation. I just got felt really fulfilled, and that started a long term relationship.
Where do you think that kind of ease about sexuality came from? For a lot of people, there's always, there's kind of conflict, and maybe not internal, but maybe coming from outside, maybe from the parents, maybe from wider afield.
I think one of the important ingredients in my background was my theatre work, and so I was working as an actor, and so we were working very close and very intimately with each other, and our training was very physical and very, very open and very understandable, and there was gay people, there was lesbians, there was straight people, there was old, there was young, and you really had the training with Raymond Hawthorne was to about respect, and it was about understanding something underneath rather than the ephemeral, if you like. It wasn't about the external, it was about the internal. And so therefore the appreciation and the way that the sex drive worked as an actor was really important as part of the training, really. And so that was a huge breakthrough for me.
What other things did acting give you?
Oh, the ability to perform and the ability to keep a story going. And to, I suppose, to live a life and just do things rather than complicate things. So it allowed me to actually say, well, I'm a gay guy and I'm in love with him, so let's do this. So it became action-orientated. And so my life became quite simple, really. And it also allowed me to live in a community of like-minded people. Because the theatre scene in Auckland was incredibly rich and incredibly fulfilling and incredibly embracing and warm. And the people, I still know people from that period who I have a deep affection for.
What years are we talking about?
Oh, this is in the 70s. This would be mid-70s when we hadn't thought anything of it, really, at the start of the time. I remember being with my partner and we were coming up from we'd been downtown, I think, or something to eat, and we're going back to the theatre, and it was raining, and we were in K Road on a Thursday night, and we were running across K Road, and he got to the middle, and he turned around, and he put his hand out, and I always remember running towards this hand, and following the hand, and holding his hand, and running across the other side of the road, laughing, and that was just the image of the freedom that we felt at that stage. There was never any thought of law, never thought of of retribution, never any thought of that. I'm sure that must have been in our mind somewhere, but I really can't remember it.
How did your family react?
My sisters were really cool. They always things, and my mother, she sort of didn't really. If that's what you want to do, that's, well, you're Johnny and you'll always be Johnny. And she was fabulous. So when we bought a house in Kingsland, I sold the Escort as the Ford Escort got sold so we could buy a house together. And so we bought a house in, must have been only 75 or 76. And Mum came up and from Tokoro with Dad, and we had a housewarming, and we had about 50, 60 people there planting the garden and all the old school friends. And it was Rangmoyne and Johnny's house, and everybody, Mum did tours of the house, showing people Johnny and Rangmoyne's bed. This is their room, and that's the guest room, and we just got on with life.
Now, the 60s and 70s in New Zealand for theatre were very, very big, weren't they?
Very bright, very bright. Especially the late 60s after Mercury started, and a lot of the training and the coming of age of New Zealand theatre happened in the 70s, as people didn't feel the need to go to England to be trained as a RADA actor before they could work here. And so you got a New Zealand type of training coming through. And so the people that were trained at Theatre Corporate with me are the people that have been the leaders in the dramatic change. I've been part of that ever since.
Did that feed into work for, say, television?
It certainly did. Certainly did, yes. Yeah, but that's not how I got into television. I actually got into television because I was acting, and I did 12 years of just repertory acting, and it was all theatre at that stage, and TV acting was something you never even considered, or film you never even considered. You know, Bruno Lawrence did that, you know, that sort of, and there were Sam Neill did that, but they were different from us as actors as such. And so we, in the... at one stage I was working in Christchurch at the Court Theatre, and I just missed my man so much, I just went, I've done this, thank you, I'm going home. And I just wanted to have a change. I just wanted to, you know, he was in Auckland, I was in Christchurch, and I just came home and said, right, that's it, I'll find another job. And I went to visit a friend of mine who had done a TV show with, and I'd just been to an employment agency looking for a job, and the only job they could give me was in the miscellaneous pile, which was an auctioneer for Turner and Growers, you know, and unfortunately I just missed that was last week, you know. And so I went to visit this friend, and he said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, what do you do? He says, well, I'm a TV producer. And I went, oh, can I do that? And he said, well, you have to work at that one. And I went, oh, okay, I'll do it. And so I got a job that week with TVNZ as a script girl. And so I became the script girl, because I could type. And so I got sent to Wellington, and Ringwana came down to Wellington, and we lived in Wellington for several years. While I trained as a TV, a script girl, then, because of my theatre background, I was given the opportunity to train as a director and became a drama director, and then I worked in drama and became a drama director in Wellington, and then a producer in Wellington, and then they moved me to Auckland, so I became a producer in Auckland and director in Auckland. So that's how I got a television.
What is a script girl?
A script girl. A script girl is now called a director's assistant or a producer's assistant. It used to be called the script girl because the script girl used to have to type the script out on a Imperial typewriter. And so they used to get the copy from the director, and their job was to do the script, so the script girl. So I was the last of the script girls, because immediately I got the job, because they couldn't call us script girls anymore. They had to call us TPAs, the Television Producers Assistants. And so I became part of the Television Producers Assistants organization. And now then they became PAs, and then DAs, and now they become production managers.
At that time, in the 80s, can you recall, were there any gay characters on television in New Zealand?
Very few indeed. It wasn't mentioned at all. If there were, there were these awful characters, Are You Being Served, which was the comic queen, or the gay character was the one who got killed in the second reel, or the one who almost won and then got killed. So it was always retribution. That's what I remember of the gay characters in that time.
What about things like Hudson and Halls, who weren't openly out, were they?
Well, to us they were. I thought it was actually I thought everybody knew they were gay. There were just two guys, and they were having a wonderful time in the kitchen, and they were gay guys on and everybody loved them. And that was sort of that English tradition, you know, where the Daniel LaRues and the people who were gay personalities, and there's a legion of the comedians, and that was just accepted. That's how they were, flamboyant characters they were called, and Hudson and Halls were like that, and they were terrific, and they never actually declared publicly out, but they were just, that's how things were. I loved them. I thought they were so funny. And they were good gay friends, and they were a good model of two guys who worked together and lived together and explored the world together and had great parties.
So when did you leave TVNZ?
I left TVNZ when I was offered a job with TV3. When they started up, I was offered a job to direct comedy programs for them, and directed comedy programs. And then, so I had to start my own company to do that. And then I worked through TV3 with the various shows and became part of the kids' productions and developed all their original stable of programs with another wonderful gay producer called Rick Simpson, who is one of the archetypes. And he's one of the Rick Simpson's he's the inspiration for children's television in this country. He is just, and he still is today.
So your production companies then started moving into things like the Hero Parade in Auckland. How was that in terms of like filming a queer pageant?
It was a fantastic opportunity. It was great. Remember the first Hero Parade, I was in Queen Street watching these people go down on the front of cars and stuff like that, and it was outrageous. And the second one was thrown out of Queen Street, and it was going down Ponsonby Road, and we thought, well, we've got to go and support that. We got there, and there was these hundreds of thousands of people in Ponsonby Road, and I was standing outside Surrendered Dorothy's with a lady called Bettina Hollings. And Bettina Hollings was the inspirational programmer for TV3. She's the one that just put the stamp on, and she had fantastic ideas. And she turned to me and she says, "We have got to do this. You do it." And so I went, "Oh, all right then." So I went and explored it, and we were standing opposite the Armadillo restaurant, which is now Sponge. And I said, "Yeah, we'll do it from up there." And I said, "We'll get the top twins." Yeah, yeah. She said, "Yeah, that's it. So next year, we decided that we could get some money from New Zealand On Air because it was a special interest group. Our community was being established now then as a special interest group because of legal changes and all sort of stuff. So we managed to put that together, and with, I think, five cameras, I think, with the top twins on the veranda, with Lucy Lawless as a guest, and we filmed the parade, and it was wonderful. And we turned it around within the week, I think it was at that stage, to an OB truck, and it went to air, and it was just wonderful. And so that was the first one. To film that sort of event had never been done before. And it was fabulous. You know, it was like, what? You know, just a wonderful show. It was a great show. It was entertaining. It was political. It was a protest. It was, we took the street. And I just wanted to capture that for TV. And so, of course, when I went to air, people around the country saw what affected this wonderful evening had on the people that were there, because we did a lot of crowd stuff as well as the floats and so on. And so it was entertainment, and it was just great.
So what were some of the issues in terms of the content? So in terms of things like kind of nudity and language, did you have any guidelines from TV3 as to what you can and can't show?
Never did it. If it was good in the streets, if police had allowed it to happen, we could film it. They never said, "Oh, we can't have any deaths," or "we can't have any of this." It's not like some of the old traditional broadcasters. They were wanting something really interesting. And they got it. And when it came down to it, it was, you know, these parades, people don't really do. In that day, it was just to be out there and to be proud. To get out and be proud, to stand up and say, "I'm gay and these are my friends." Because it was all about gays and friends and people being heroes and people supporting the people with HIV.
Are there many productions like that where it's actually just down to a programmer saying, "Oh, let's do that," and you go away and do it? Or do you often have to kind of like pitch an idea or...
Oh, most of the time, yeah. Most of the time you pitch the idea. You get the idea for it and you pitch it. And so every season has to be pitched new. What's the changes? What's the standards for it? How it's going to work? What's your personnel going to do? Nowadays, it's far more codified. And really, really just the inspirational period when things are starting up. We may find the same thing with Channel 4. We may find the same thing in the future with internet channels, where people will just be inspired just to do something and just do it. And give the creative people a bit of freedom to do it. I think a lot of the network control now is what are we delivering and how are we delivering it, and that prescriptive method of production tends to limit the inspiration and the joy of the productions. So when we started doing looking at Queer Nation, for example, it had already done a few short seasons on the TV2 type channel in Auckland, and so I was asked to take it on with Nettie and Libby and Andrew, and so they were going to do it, and I was the executive producer, and I gave the infrastructure for it and to the production company, which would allow the relationship with the network to be developed and how that would happen with TVNZ. And it was very supportive from the network's point of view. We had to do the proposals of what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, what support we had, the formality of it had to be done, because we were asking for an awful lot of money at that stage just to do 20 episodes. And that's how the first thing happened.
For each episode, how much would it cost, roughly?
I think the first one was around about 20,000 or 24,000 per episode, whereas the normal programs were being made for 115. You know, they were much, much bigger than that. And so this was a really cheap program for the network.
Why was that?
Basically, it was a minority program. And therefore, it was fast turnaround. Therefore, we got it in there. It could be done for that price. And we did it because that's the way we could get it. Because we knew we could get round about that price for the program.
You're saying that the network's supportive, but when you look at some of the broadcast time slots that are apportioned to, say, like queer programming, they seem like 11 o'clock on a Thursday night or what have you. Was there any kind of conflict in terms of where
huge. One of our big problems was not content, it was time. The time was going to air, and you have to remember, in those days you just went to air once and that was it, and if they gave you a repeat, it was in the middle of the night, so you might get a night repeat. So there's twice a week it goes out, and once at 11 o'clock our most successful time slot in Auckland was with the local community station Triangle, and they put it on at 9 o'clock, and of course a lot of the Auckland people watched it at 9 o'clock, and it was terrific. We had, right up to the Director General, when Ian Fraser was the Director General, was requests to move it into prime time. We were suggesting it go into the 10 o'clock slot, and 10 o'clock would have made the transition into a wider audience rather than a specialized audience. And what we were finding in our ratings, even at the 11 o'clock slot, was that we had an incredibly wide range of audience watching right throughout the country. Like, it wasn't just urban, it wasn't just a gay population or a male population or a identified urban population. It was generally right throughout the country. And it was mixed.
So was there any thought in terms of having a queer show on a mainstream channel? Was there any thought in terms of not doctoring, but altering content to get to a wide as possible audience? I'm thinking in terms of, you know, what content you have and how you say that with the kind of language that you use.
Mm-hmm. It's an issue that we discussed lots. But we came down to I was the executive producer. The day-to-day running was Andrew and Nettie, basically, and Libby, and the team that ran it. And we made a point of the gay program was a gay program made for gay people by gay people. And how they expressed themselves was how we talk. That we decided that it wasn't our place to make a gay program explaining gaydom to a straight audience. If a straight audience wanted to come and watch it and see, this is our program, this is what we do, this is our issues, this is what we deal with, this is how things are happening, this is what our art artists are doing, this is what our social life is like, this is what our leaders are like, you know, in our community, that's what made it real, true, and accurate. And therefore it was pungent and it worked. And we found that if we tried to change it so that it was actually, let me explain a blowjob to the straight community, then you go, no, what's the point? You know? And it just went silly.
So how did the queer community respond?
We got amazing support. Every year we had to do a reapplication for the money, for the funding for the next year. And we, especially Nettie was excellent at this, and she'd just contact people around the community and say, what is it, what's the program meant to you this year? Could you send us a letter of support and things? And the letters of support were fantastic. It was really good. So that's the first part of it. Always supportive. But my God, our community's bitchy. Oh, heavens. You know, take a group of queer people. My God, the tongues get sharpened. We were terrible. We did this and we did that. It was just that. Just special meetings. We were ripped apart, you know. But when it came down to it, when it went away, people went, oh, but we really like that. You know, so to speak. And so the it meant something to the community. And it meant people wanted it to be right. Then the huge arguments that went over it. And that's because it was important. But people just thought it was just, oh, it's so terrible.
Yeah. So how does that kind of feedback affect you?
Oh, look, it was, that's part of broadcasting. You know, reactions of people to do things. We make the programs. You know, we try to be as empathetic. We try to work with. We're working with other people. We're not elitist as such. We're telling people stories, and some stories are upsetting, and some stories had to come out. You know, that upset people, and others were just great fun. And each year there was a different sort of feel. You know, we got told that we were one year we were far too party. You know, and it turned out it was the titles, because the titles, we made new titles every year, and because one of the titles had a mirror ball in it. So everybody thought that we were just doing the party scene. You see what I mean? So everybody interpreted that the whole thing was party. We went back and looked at it and went, no, we're not doing that. But the perception of it was.
Can you recall the most controversial topic you've covered?
Most controversial subject, going into the detail, kind of. We had a ban on photography when there was somebody peeing into somebody's mouth. We had that as an issue at one stage, and it was a publicly exposed photograph in an exhibition, and we had filmed it and we put it on air, and that contravened a standard of some sort. You know, seemingly it wasn't the peeing itself, I think it was the mouth or something like that. You know, it was one of these sort of standards. And we always did that. As far as controversy goes, we had controversy all the time. The hero issues about what was happening with hero and what things. The right wing. We did a marvellous series on the launch of the right-wing opposition to gay community through one of the big, through the American church corporations standing up here, and a wonderful reporter just followed that relentlessly, and he was like a terrier. He got this issue and he just worked with it, and until it became very clear that it became publicly known that this was what this church group, Research Foundation, were actually putting out anti-gay propaganda, which basically was hate, the hate legislation that we got changed. So it was effective. The program was effective in getting information out to our community and getting feedback to the political system to make things change. And we kept going right through the civil union debate, all right through that period. And one of the big arguments was keeping the program on air at that stage was that we needed to know what was going on. And the network program has kept us doing it at that stage.
Through that time of the 90s and early 2000s, there wasn't a huge amount of kind of queer programming on television. And I'm just wondering, with your shows, did that invite more broadcast complaints from, say, kind of right-wing groups or religious groups? Did you feel that you were being targeted?
Yeah, and originally we were. Originally, when the first programs that Nettie, Andrew and Lidway made, and they were banned in Dunedin, banned in Nelson. You know, they weren't allowed to broadcast, all that sort of stuff. But once the program went on to air and became part of the national psyche, sure, people targeted it, but we just kept on going. That was our job. We just kept on going. So I never, I didn't feel it became a magnet for right-wing criticism. It became Queer Nation. And when we did research on it, the name Queer Nation had a 99% recognition rate in the general, you know, when they do those surveys, as the queer program. And so that's what the queer program was, and that's where people went to watch it, and that's where people got their information about what was happening and how to come out and where you came out, what other people, and support for people. So that was our sort of basic thing.
How do you feel about being a pioneer in terms of queer TV in New Zealand?
How do I feel about being a pioneer? I never thought of it in those ways. It was just, that's what we did. And that was what my school was doing at the time. And it was successful. And so I really feel rewarded for the effort that the whole team of people put in. And where we went to with it, with some really talented production people, both on the camera and the sound and the writing and the research side of it, and the people that came and joined the team each year, and that changed each year. We got different perspectives on it, and to actually be the executive producer, so to make that happen, is a rich reward, a really rich reward. And I feel like that's a major thing I've been able to help with.
Why did it end?
Change of network. Change of network executives, change of priorities, change of climate within the broadcasting industry and the community. And there was a person who took over working at TVNZ who just destroyed the communication between us and the community, and treated people really badly, and people felt assaulted by what the network was doing. And it was a terrible time. It was a terrible time. And so people felt unsure about whether they want to work in it, and whether they had the community support. And it just, and there was some, it was a terrible time. And there was a bit of a, in that time, there was a bit of a disorientation in the community as well about what are we going to do? Why are we doing this? And TVNZ decided that they wanted to cover a program that was different, because Queer Nation's been there for a while, so they want something different. So they went and found things that were different, and the other different programs supplied some difference, but it didn't satisfy it. It didn't give something that I think the community really wanted. And so gradually over a couple of years, it's disappeared.
So is there, for want of a better word, a quota in terms of like queer broadcasting on New Zealand television that you can only have one queer show on at any one time?
Not really. New Zealand and I would never look at it like that. But the money was allocated to queer programming, as the money would be allocated in their minds, if you like, special interest programs were Tangata Pacifica with the Pacific Island one, the Asian program, the Christian program, queer program, and you know, there was a number of them bundled into that sort of money that was allocated. So it wasn't a quota, it was just like, it was that's the money there. And so even when Queer Nation network decided to try something else, the money was still sort of there for us to use, but because the network wouldn't support it, they ended up with small programs, different sort of programs. But I think we went through about four different styles. They couldn't make up their mind what they wanted, and one of the problems was that they wanted to reach the straight audience. They didn't want that was one of the main. We can get a wider audience, and so then it was. As you can imagine, we were very confused.
So at the time, in the mid-2000s, there was no kind of idea that you could use that broadcasting money to, say, broadcast on the internet, or that wasn't a possibility for you?
No, not for the broadcasting on the internet was just too complicated, and the convergence hadn't happened. What we had done in the Queer Nation series was develop websites Queer Nation website, and we had a marvellous website person. And so we employed them as an extra, if you like, in the team, and they started interactive websites. And so people would enter their information. They could find all the programs. We find ways of doing the program and letting them share the program through the website. And then we discovered that if we were going to put it up there for them to watch, we'd have to pay this much for it. And so we went to New Zealand On Air and TVNZ and said, well, if we're going to do that, we'd like to get $25,000 a year just to do that side of it. Oh, no, we can't. And the New Zealand On Air weren't allowed to give us money for the net. And so we had to get rid of our net because we couldn't afford to do it, as well as keep the program going with the rising costs and everything like that. So one of the saddest times of Queer Nation was when the year we had to stop having a focus on the internet. And so the Queer Nation website just sort of stopped developing.
And it's interesting now, in hindsight, that could have been, again, seen as pioneering because... you know, 5 years later.
Absolutely. And it was all there. It was all there, ready to go. We kept a server in the office that could have been plugged in at any time. It was because we had really talented people. It was a great team. It was a wonderful team. And that's the pioneer side of it. It was great. And people were calling up and the interchange of letters was happening. And people were getting emails and people were getting information and were putting on extra information for stories. All the stuff that's happening now. But we just thought that would be really good for us to do.
Was Queer Nation ever seen outside of New Zealand?
Yes, it was. We went to Cannes. We took it to Cannes, MIPCOM at Cannes, as a minority program, and tried to sell it to gay broadcasting because it was just nascent gay broadcasting. And there was a wonderful channel happening in London, and there was a lovely channel happening in Canada, in Toronto. And so we met up with those on that trip, and we sold it to them. And just before we signed the contracts, you might remember in that period, they had a meltdown with the football rights. And all these people had to suddenly pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for football rights. And so all the money that was going to go into the queer program in these people's digital platforms disappeared. So we ended up selling it in a format to a Canadian channel. And we repackaged the Queer Nation stories into two programs. One was called the G-Spot, which was male, gay. It was the gay, everything to do with G, and it was all the gay stories. And the woman one, all the lesbian stories went into She-Spot. I think it was She-Spot. It was something like that. It was two different women, and we repackaged it for international sale, and they bought it and played it for a number of years, and they just recycled it. But again, they went through recycling as well, restructuring, and it's turned, now it's turned into a different type of a different world. But we did get it seen there, yes.
What do you think your biggest lessons learnt from doing something like Queer Nation were?
Nothing works better than personal commitment to things. It's something that comes from inside you. Communication comes from inside you. And therefore, so my lesson is, I was a gay man, I was making a gay program, and therefore it was good to do, and it was rewarding to do. And I had all sorts of problems with it, but that's what we did. So passion. Passion and commitment is what makes good broadcasting.
What about the future of queer broadcasting?
Immense future for it, because we tell great stories. You know, communication media is about storytelling, and if we have good storytellers telling good stories, we've now got the devices to get them to people. We've got the means of communication. Whereas the means of communication was a monopoly held by very few people in this country. To get to people, you went through TVNZ or TV3. That's how you got to them. you know, and you might have wanted to get to them through Sky or the international platforms, but that was we never considered in the 2000s. We never considered that as a platform for us. Now, with the internet, with internet channels, with the ability to deliver specifically to specific audiences, the days of broadcasting are numbered. The days of narrowcasting is the future. So narrowcasting doesn't mean that it's necessarily a smaller audience, but it's an audience that is worldwide and can be reached. And so our stories in New Zealand, if they're accurate, if they're clear, and if they're passionate, are very relevant to an audience around the world. That's where I see the future of us.
It must be an amazing journey for you to have been in broadcasting over this period where, you know, when you think like back in the 80s where it was a monopoly in terms of BCNZ, who had radio, TV, the symphony orchestra, and now where it's so diverse.
Ah, yeah, sure. What a wonderful, wonderful time to be here, you know, and you sort of go, whoa, well, how come we didn't know all that was going to happen? The interesting thing about it is that there's diversity there, but there's sort of a dumbing down of it as well, as the commercial side of it goes for more and more money out of it, more and more audiences, and goes for lower common denominator, and doesn't want to offend. No, it's not offending, because some channels do want to offend, but it's about, it seems to be the lack of content. It seems to be driven by different things. And so there's immense opportunities, but they're not being fulfilled because the commercialization of the industry is leading to an undermining of content. So people are not expressing themselves. They're in sound bites, or doesn't fit the format, or it's they want real people doing real things in a false situation like reality TV, which is a good docker. There's nothing like a good doco, you know. Who needs to put people on an island to do that? We've got a country called New Zealand. It is Survivor, you know. There's the doco.
At the same time as Queer Nation, you were also involved with GABA, the Gay Auckland Business Association, and you became president.
Yes, I did. After Queer Nation finished, because as a media person, I just felt uncomfortable being involved in a group when we were trying to cover things, although I was very supportive of Gay Auckland Business. And that started way back in homosexual law reform, and it became a vehicle for... and for men and women in the professions to have an ability to speak without being chastised. And it was very successful in that period, and it was very successful for homosexual law reform. GABA then developed into really good in networking opportunities, and so I got involved with it at that stage and became the president, and did a lot of the stuff we were doing in Queer Nation, and we still did it with the organisation, like for example doing the Queer of the Year and just having awards, and so giving Helen Clark a Queer of the Year award, and so she'd come and meet the community, and so she'd meet us at dinner and have a good meet us and talk to us and express things. So we did things with the council, elections, and getting the gay voice out into the community and getting our voice articulated, and doing fun events. You know, let's just get together and have a bit of a party. And we like that. That's good fun. And so it was a very inclusive organization. That's what I liked about it. Because it was business, it was professional, it was people who worked as teachers as well as in the commercial industry. It was law people as well as people who did gardening, you know, men and women. And it was a really good group of people of a variety of ages. Tended to be a bit maturer than what was happening at the clubs. But that's not to say that all the GABA members were not down at the clubs as well.
So in all the things that you've done in terms of like theatre, TV, things like GABA as well, what's been the highlight for you?
One of the highlights for me was the Gay Games in Sydney, where we knew the Gay Games in Sydney were happening. It was the first time a great international event of that magnitude had come to here, and we were determined to actually make it a broadcasting event. So we lobbied TVNZ and lobbied Australia and lobbied other broadcasters and put together a team, just like they do for the Olympics and just for the international games, and came up with an idea of doing the Gay Games for New Zealand. And it went through all sorts of ups and downs and changes and things, but we finally took our queer nation and went to Sydney, and we went out every day and made stories. Just the same as we'd done for Queer Nation, going out and filming, came back to a base in Sydney, edited it, and I got on a plane with the tape, came back to New Zealand, and then we rushed up and gave it to the network, and they played it. And there was, and we played it within the week. So people here were watching what was happening in Sydney that week. And so we did the specials. And I remember being with Andrew in Oxford Street and going, This is what we've always wanted to do, is to go somewhere with our people and tell their stories in the gay world. And we were meeting wonderful people and telling wonderful stories. And that, I think we made two big hour-long specials. And they repeated them because people just had to see them. And that was one of the highlights of my gay TV world.
So are there issues within the queer community now that has everything been resolved, or what are the issues for you, I guess?
Well, I suppose the issue for me at the moment is maturity and being growing into a community. And I was 60 on January the 10th. And so that was a big surprise to me, you know, because 60 was always the old people going. And so therefore I don't feel like I sort of think I should feel when I was 60, you know, as a mature retiring member of the community and going gracefully into the future. And so I think there's a big issue on aging in our community. We have gone, the people who are now into the baby boomers, who are now into the mature years in their life, have suffered enormously. We are the generation that lost our friends. We are the people who suffered through the HIV and AIDS epidemics, and that we have lost a whole generation of leaders. The people that we would have followed, you know, there were people that were older than us who died prematurely. So just like the East Coast lost a whole generation of Maori leaders in World War II with the Maori Battalion and the World War I, World War II, they lost a whole lot of generation, and therefore they're handicapped. And so for the aging generation of our community is missing this group of people. So therefore we've got to find another way of doing it. And so I think the maturing and the way we look after our senior community members is going to be one of the issues over the next few years of how our community defines itself in this country. It's all very well to be young, fit and beautiful and having a lovely time and falling in love and this sort of stuff, but we want to know that we can do this through our lives. It's not just a passing phase. And so I think the maturing of the community and how we deal with people going into retirement, what sort of life we're going to have as senior members of our community, is something that I'm facing, and I know other people are interested in it too. We don't want to get the situation of gay men and women around the country going into retirement homes and having to go to the closet, for example, you know, or become outrageous. Which was the other way of doing it in the past.
So this series is all about people making a difference to their communities in a variety of different ways. And I guess I'm wondering, would you have any advice for somebody sitting there thinking, what can I do? How can I make a difference? Where do I start? What do I do? How do I get involved? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I suppose you start with one. You start with one. Making a difference is about one conversation with one person. And it's a true conversation. And then you have one with one. Like Queer Nation started with a conversation between Andrew Whiteside and myself in a coffee bar on Ponsonby Road. And he was going, oh, we don't know, you know, what do you think we could do? And I said, well, what you could do is this. And so then they came back, and the next time Libby and Nettie and I and Andrew got together, and that was the small group. Then the next time we got together with other people, and we gradually got the network involved. You know, so we gradually built it from just one conversation. Start it is the best advice. Feel a passion and start it. If you've got an idea for a story, you start it by writing it down. You know, then you've got something to talk to somebody about. Then you've got something to, how can we take this to the next step? And so you take it one bit at a time. And therefore the passion becomes the driver. The identity, the who you are. If it's not you, if it doesn't feel like you, it won't work. You've got to be you to do it.
This program was funded by a generous grant from the Gay Auckland Business Association Charitable Trust. For more information, visit gabba.org.nz.